Ross has all the spring deals you want, so you can say yes to more looks for you and your budget. Tube tops for less? Yes. Dad shorts for the weekend? Yes. Mini skirts for less than online? That's a yes for you and your bank account. Find your certified yes for me moment and save 20 to 60% off department store prices every day at Ross. Hurry in for spring deals today. Items and styles vary by store.
With the glaring exception of Mike Pence, prominent Republican leaders across the country have pretty much all fallen in line behind Donald Trump. He is the presumptive Republican nominee. As far as the presidential race is concerned, the Republican Party is a pretty united front. But when you look at the Republican Party beyond the scope of just the cult of Trump, when you look at the part of the party that Donald Trump would actually have to work with to govern, unity is not the first word that comes to mind. Today, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives passed its biggest legislative accomplishment so far. It voted to keep the lights on. After kicking the can down the road for six whole months, Republicans in Congress finally funded the federal government with a $1.2 trillion spending bill, and most of them didn't even vote to do that. Despite having a majority in the House, only about a half of today's votes came from Republicans. It was Democrats who actually brought this funding extension over the finish line. And because Congress took so long to pass this thing, it's only going to actually keep the government funded through the end of September, which means we have 6 months, and then we're right back into this totally unnecessary mess again. And I'm not kidding when I say that this is the bare minimum. This vote to just fund the government, to keep it open, to keep the lights on. I'm not kidding when I say it's the biggest thing the Republican-controlled House has managed to get done. Don't take that from me. Remember this outburst from the Texas Republican Congressman Chip Roy last November?
One thing. I want my Republican colleagues to give me one thing, one, that I can go campaign on and say we did. One. Anybody sitting in the complex, if you want to come down to the floor and come explain to me one material, meaningful, significant thing the Republican majority has done besides, well, I guess it's not as bad as the Democrats.
When Chip Roy made that plea to his Republican colleagues last November, this session on Congress was on track to be the least productive session since the Great Depression. And in the 4 months since Chip Roy's speech, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives has accomplished essentially nothing. No aid package for Ukraine, even as Ukrainian troops are literally running out of bullets. No border deal, even after House Republicans spent months hyping one and negotiating for one that they could agree to. All Republican Speaker Mike Johnson and his colleagues have done for months now is waste everybody's time. But again, why take my word for that? Today was Colorado Republican Congressman Ken Buck's last day. He resigned earlier. Here he was last week explaining why he was calling it quits.
This place just keeps going downhill, and I don't need to spend my time here.
That's the kind of statement you might expect from a disaffected middle manager at Starbucks, not a sitting member of Congress. Congress is supposed to be the greatest legislative body in the world, not a place where people think they're wasting their time. But it's not just Ken Buck who thinks it's a waste of time. This session of Congress has seen more members resign than any other session on record. It's literally unprecedented, and that makes sense. If you're not a clown, why stick around this long at the clown show? But with all of these resignations also comes a glimmer of hope. Maybe Republicans won't be in charge that much longer. Because today, we saw yet another resignation announcement. The Wisconsin Republican Congressman and rising star, Mike Gallagher. Mike Gallagher only announced his resignation today. His actual last day is going to be April the 19th, which under Wisconsin state law is too late in the session for his seat to be filled with a special election, meaning that Gallagher's deeply red district seat will remain vacant until January. And all of this is to say that come April 20th, the House Republican majority will have a one-vote lead. And again, the Republican Party isn't exactly the poster child of unity right now. Last week was supposed to be the big annual retreat for House Republicans, the retreat where they discuss their legislative priorities and they strategize for the months ahead. I say it was supposed to be that because more than half the House Republican caucus just didn't show up. One Republican member of Congress anonymously told both Axios and Politico, quote, "I'd rather sit down with Hannibal Lecter and eat my own liver." That is one dissatisfied worker right there. And then today, the far-right Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to oust the Republican Speaker of the House, her Speaker, Mike Johnson, from his position. And while I don't actually think anything will come of Representative Greene's motion, at least not today, I do think the reasoning behind her motion is notable. She was upset that Speaker Johnson passed the spending bill today to keep the government's lights on. That was her big complaint. And now tonight, that spending bill, the very basic bill that all but tore the Republican Party apart in the House tonight, that bill is still stuck in the Senate, where senators have until midnight to pass it, or a huge chunk of the federal government, in fact, will shut down. And one of the key things to watch tonight is if any one senator pushes for amendments, because that could tank the bill. The House is no longer in session, so they'd essentially be sending the bill back to an empty House. As Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse puts it tonight, it looks like we're headed for a shutdown at the hands of Senate Republican gremlins who know that amendments can't pass because there's no House to send an amendment back to. He continued, "I sure hope I'm wrong, but the Republican Senate caucus is a rudderless ship right now, so the gremlins are running the show," end quote. Our national political discourse is centered primarily around how Donald Trump is a bull in a china shop. He's anti-demographic. He's anti-xenophobic. I mean, he is xenophobic. He's not anti-xenophobic. He's an existential threat to our nation. But even without him, the Republican Party right now is dangerous. They are dangerously bad at doing their job, and the Americans and the world needs America and its key lawmaking body to function right now. Joining us, MSNBC contributor and columnist Charlie Sykes and Brendan Buck, former MSNBC political analyst and former press secretary to the House Speaker, John Boehner. Guys, good to see you. Thank you for being with us. Brendan, you've seen shows, they're not really like this. You've seen shows before where there's been disarray. You certainly were, you were a press secretary to a speaker who had to, wrangle a bunch of cats, a herd of cats. This is unlike anything any of us have ever seen before.
Yeah, bleak is the word that comes to mind, and I have a hard time disagreeing with any of your intro there. Where to start? This is bordering on a completely wasted Congress, and for all of the effort and all of the hyping that Republicans did coming in, how they were going to change Washington and do all of these things, they're probably going to end this Congress having done literally nothing other than fund the government and increase the debt limit. Now, there is still a chance. I'm not ruling out the idea that Mike Johnson could bring up some aid to Ukraine and Israel and do something really meaningful there. But I think what Marjorie Taylor Greene did today was almost entirely about Ukraine. It was about getting attention for herself, of course. But that was her shot to Mike Johnson saying, don't you dare bring up any Ukraine aid. Not a single dollar can go there or I'm going to take you out. Now, I don't know whether she'll be successful in that. I don't know if Democrats will go along with that. But the one thing that they could still get done and try to save the Congress having some record of accomplishment, she has now done a shot across the bow. And I don't know if this is the type of speaker who's going to be willing to risk his job for something like that.
Charlie, what's your take on all of this and how it's going down?
Well, I mean, look, governing is hard, legislating is hard, and this is what happens when you have a party that is not serious about either one of them. I mean, they are in this doom loop of dysfunction, as you mentioned, and now watching their majority go to one, you do wonder what's going to happen. I mean, I know Mike Gallagher pretty well. I know that Brendan probably does as well. This is a rising star in the Republican Party. And he's basically said, I don't want to be part of this anymore. I mean, you are seeing this exodus, this brain drain from people who go, you know what? Maybe if I stuck around, I could be speaker. But why would I want to do that? Why would I want to sit in this caucus for two more years with Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and Matt Gaetz? And so they are leaving. And the result is this complete do nothing Congress. Now, I think the interesting question is, what do Democrats do? Do they bail out Speaker Johnson? Do they use this dysfunction in a way to leverage aid for Israel and Ukraine? We're in totally unprecedented waters. But again, you know, it is amazing. You're going into an election year, a presidential election year, and the Republican Party is putting its own unwillingness to act like a serious governing political party on vivid display on a regular basis. It's become a blood sport. How many speakers do they have to sacrifice on the altar of Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz's extremism before they settle down to actually doing the business of the country? Not clear yet.
Brendan, this is a good question. What do Democrats do about this? There have been instances in the last several months where Democrats, even while McCarthy was Speaker, helped out. They helped out the Speaker against and the anarchy that might otherwise rule. But at some point, the whole thing's unclear. It's not clear whether Mike Johnson's actually worried about his Speaker role. He says he's just focusing on the business of the House, except there's no actual business of the House. You've got the Marjorie Taylor Greens. You've got this rule that they can vacate the chair if one person calls for it, and they can vote on it. If you are Democrats in the House, do you wish to extend the hand to save this, or do you wish for this to sort of collapse under its own weight so that something else can happen?
Well, I think it probably depends on what happens next. Obviously, we saw with Kevin McCarthy, they made the decision that it's really not their problem to save him. And they were happy to see him go. Now, that was probably the result of a lot of distrust that built up over a long period of time. I don't know that distrust exists with Mike Johnson, but I'm pretty sure that the scenario in which Marjorie Taylor Greene brings a motion to vacate would be around Johnson moving Ukraine aid. And if Democrat, and that's something that Democrats want. And so I'm not so sure that Democrats are going to do the same thing as last time if the context is they're trying to kick him out for doing something that Democrats wanted. Now, that is not a good place to be if you're the Speaker having to rely on the minority to save your job. And it's a terrible way for him to be able to negotiate something because you know Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to be breathing down his neck the entire time. It's terrible politics within his own conference because she's just going to be criticizing him as colluding with the minority. So I think that they would probably save him. And you've seen some comments already from Democrats saying, look, if he's going to bring up what he knows is the right thing to do, we'll probably save him. I just don't know if he's the type of person who would be willing to put himself in that position in the first place and even test it.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, Charlie, you and I have talked about is that the Chaos Caucus is a minority. There are almost as many Republicans who won in Biden districts who'd like to be reelected again. And yet they wield. I mean, this entire discussion is weird because it's all the things that haven't happened in the Republican conference because of these chaos-y people. It's not even the rump of the Republican conference, which is interesting to me.
Well, and yes, and they've allowed themselves to be held hostage by this because the alternative is, as Brendan points out, relying on Democrat votes, in effect, creating kind of a coalition government. But we know how that would play with the Republican base. And of course, you know, the gorilla in the room here is what is Donald Trump going to do? What would happen if Mike Johnson did cut a deal with Democrats? What would the word be from Mar-a-Lago? You know, part of the problem is this chaos caucus is egged on and encouraged by the leader of the Republican Party, Donald Trump. And Donald Trump he thrives on this. He doesn't want to see a functional Congress. I don't think he would mind seeing a government shutdown. He's certainly not going to support the Ukraine aid. So it's hard to figure out exactly how Republicans manage to come out of this looking like anything other than a clown car on fire.
Now, except, Brendan, for a few key people in that chaos bunch of members of the conference, they're actually doing okay with it. Here's Greg Murphy, the Republican congressman from North Carolina, on Newsmax tonight talking about something that's been happening in the last few days.
Sadly enough, what I just got a text not 30 minutes ago from Marjorie saying I'm wanting to raise money on this. Matt Gaetz raised money the whole week or the whole time he was creating chaos. This is not what it's supposed to be. This is not what adults in the room do.
So there is some motivation for this other than chaos, Brendan. Some people are enjoying this. I don't know what the end game is for the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world and Matt Gaetz out of chaos, but there are people who are actually giving them money to say, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, relevance is what they're after. They want to be... Marjorie Taylor Greene filed this motion to vacate and stepped out of the Capitol, and there were almost 100, it seemed like, reporters piled around her. That's what she wanted. She wants to be able to have us talking about her. She wants to be able to fundraise. But it's not just her. This is the game right now. These are the incentives. Every single one of them is out for themselves. You know, as we all know, politics is supposed to be a team sport, and you can't get anything done unless you're working as a team. But everybody out there sees this. Everybody saw what Matt Gaetz did, and it works out for him. Now he gets to travel around with the president. They all want to be like that. And, you know, the irony is, as much as these guys are, you know, blowing up the House, all they're doing is empowering Democrats. As you pointed out, the bill today was overwhelmingly passed by Democrats. Anything that happens in the House right now has to have Democrats' hands on it. They're achieving no conservative goals. And that's been the maddening part all along. These people who blow up the system in the name of conservatism only make things move towards Democrats every single time they do it.
Guys, thanks for your time tonight. We appreciate it. Charlie Sykes is an MSNBC columnist. Brendan Buck is a former press secretary to the former Speaker of the House. All right, we've got much more to get to tonight, including Trump's upcoming return to Wall Street, which has sparked a meme stock-like frenzy. But is it something he can cash in on to post bond? But first, over in Moscow, the Russian investigative committee says more than 60 people are now dead after gunmen opened fire at a concert hall. ISIS is now claiming responsibility. I'll talk to a reporter about that next. Next.
Ross has all the spring deals you want, so you can say yes to more looks for you and your budget. Tube tops for less? Yes. Dad shorts for the weekend? Yes. Mini skirts for less than online? That's a yes for you and your bank account. Find your certified yes for me moment and save 20 to 60% off department store prices every day at Ross. Hurry in for spring deals today. Items and styles vary by store.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley, in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
A claim of responsibility for a major terror attack in Moscow tonight has apparently come from a branch of ISIS. At least 60 people have been killed and 145 others, reportedly including children, have been wounded at a concert hall on the outskirts of Moscow. Those casualty figures come from the Russian Investigative Committee, which means they're tough for us to verify. Now, ISIS has provided no proof of its involvement in the attack or for its claim that the attackers escaped safely. The claim of responsibility was posted on a social media site by the ISIS-affiliated news agency Amaq. What we do know from verified videos from the scene is what the gunmen wearing camouflage started doing. They started firing on the crowd gathered for a Friday night concert by a popular Russian rock band. And witnesses say the attackers tossed incendiary devices around as well. A fire then broke out, engulfing much of the building and causing a partial roof collapse, according to the Russian state-run media. Massive security breach comes just days after Vladimir Putin cemented his rule over Russia for another 6 years after a tightly orchestrated presidential election in which he faced no legitimate opposition. Joining me now is the NBC News reporter Matthew Bodner, who has covered Russia for quite some time. Matthew, thanks for being with us. I know you've been working your sources. What are you hearing this could be? There's a whole lot of confusion as to who's behind it. A group has claimed responsibility, but that's not completely verified just yet.
Correct, Ali. I think this is really going to be, I think, moving into tomorrow and through the weekend, kind of the core issue of this story moving forward is who actually did this. And more importantly, is who is the Kremlin saying did this? I think that's really the crux of this. We, of course, have that claim from an ISIS media outlet that ISIS did it, an ISIS group was responsible. Also claiming that at least some of the attackers seem to have made it back to their bases, wherever they were operating from. So it does seem that this may be ongoing a little bit. But I think, you know, this question of who did it is going to be important, because basically already from the Kremlin, from Russian sources, we're hearing all kinds of things. But one of them that really stands out to me is from Margarita Simonyan, who's the editor-in-chief of Russia Today, one of, I would say, the two main chief propagandists, for lack of a better word, in Russia, alleging, seeming to cast doubt on the ISIS claim, calling it fake news. And I think the fact that the United States is coming out saying that we were warning about a potential ISIS event, we shared this information with the Russians. Now, we don't know how specific that information was, but the fact that this is coming from the U.S., that you already have people close to the Kremlin appearing to reject that explanation and a continued silence from the Kremlin, for that matter, I think really kind of highlights that this is going to be the key question. Because, you know, as we've seen in the past, Russia, this government, this regime, I think, is no stranger to large-scale terror events. Early on in Putin's presidency, this was something we saw a number of times. And each time it was used to justify, for lack of a better word, a slide towards authoritarianism, harsher security measures, wars in Chechnya. So much of what Putin's government has become today, major steps were taken in the wake of events just like this one. So this all goes to say this question of who did it, what happened here, is going to be a little bit of a political football potentially, but it's huge implications for where this goes from here.
You're going to continue to check on it. We will as well. Matthew, good to see you. Thank you for being with us. Matthew Bodner for us in London. All right, still ahead, we are going to bring you new information about a number of the stories that we are covering tonight. You're watching Alex Wagner Tonight. We'll be right back.
Capella University is rethinking higher education. With their game-changing FlexPath format, you can earn your degree on your schedule, so you can fit education seamlessly into your life. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Being a journalist is about asking important questions, and I'm about to ask a question that I never anticipated asking in my career. What do you imagine Donald Trump smells like? Well, you don't actually have to guess, because the former president is now selling Victory 47 perfume for both men and women. According to the product description, each $99 bottle, which I tried very hard to get my hands on tonight, contains the, quote, signature scent of strength and success. A crisp opening of citrus blends into a cedar heart underpinned by a rich base of leather and amber, creating a commanding presence, end quote. With a discerning enough nose, you might also detect top notes of a cash grab by a man whose bill for $500 million has come due. Monday is Trump's deadline to post the bond needed to delay enforcement of the $464 million fine from his New York civil fraud trial. If he doesn't find that money somewhere, the New York Attorney General can begin seizing Trump's assets, including his Seven Springs golf course. As the deadline approaches, the former president is selling perfume and stocks, meme stocks almost. Today, Trump's media company approved a merger to take Truth Social public, and the attention has caused the valuation to balloon. The merger is expected to close as early as next week, and Trump's 60% stake in the company could be worth $3 billion. Now, if those inflated share prices hold for a while, could Trump use them to post his bond? I know just the person to ask. Joining me now is Neil Peterson, owner of the New York-based Peterson and Sons Surety Bond Agency. Neil, good to see you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having
me. We have been asking people who know about these things these questions all week because most of us know nothing about this, right? We have no idea how this world of bonds and surety works. Let's start with the basics. Donald Trump's got to do something on Monday, and he doesn't appear to be able to have done it. He doesn't appear to have gotten the bonds that he needs. What do you think is happening now and what happens on Monday?
I think he's working diligently to obtain the bond. If he doesn't post it by Monday, I still think there's an uphill battle for Letitia James to execute on the judgment and seize his assets. I don't think it's going to be as simple as, you know, going to 40 Wall Street and auctioning off as she has said to the press. So I think there's going to be accounts restrained, maybe some cash seized, some bank accounts levied, and I think there's going to be a further proceeding to have them turned over to her, which is going to take some time.
So what do you think can happen? He says, I can't raise the bond needed. She says, actually, you can because you don't have to have it done as one bond. Tell me what that means.
In theory, you could post bonds from a couple different surety companies to add up to the full value. That becomes a little messy because on the back end, you would need, let's say if you use 10 companies, there would have to be some sort of agreement to...
Who gets what? What order they get it in?
Yes. Yeah. So getting 10 companies to agree to anything is very difficult. Even if you had four or five, it's going to be complicated. No one wants to agree to be the first person to pay.
And the issue is if you have to pay, meaning if the judgment goes against Donald Trump, his appeal goes against him, and the bond company now has to pay the money, in exchange for that, in theory, you'd have taken assets worth more than what you have to pay up. So what's the problem? What's the risk to the bond company?
So the real risk is that judgments, once they're affirmed on appeal, have to be paid within 5 to 10 days.
Right.
If you pledge real estate, it's not liquid. You can't liquidate it quickly. That could take months to a year to do. A company doesn't want to lay out $500 million pending, you know, recouping about the same or more with interest and penalties once the real estate's sold. The other aspect is that most real estate has a first or second position. So no one wants to come in as a second or third creditor, right, on the property. And then lastly, if the former president gets reelected, a bond secured by an indemnification agreement. It's never been, a surety company has never had to execute on an indemnity against a sitting president. That is going to have challenges in itself.
So bottom line is these surety companies are like, we got enough business. This is too complicated for us.
Correct. They're not very forward thinking companies. It's one of the oldest industries in the country. They're not reinventing their underwriting cycle or
right.
process. They're taking select risks that are intelligent. It's supposed to be a zero loss game.
So if you were good at this, if you knew how to handle real estate, big real estate in Manhattan, and you said, all right, you know what, you're probably going to lose your appeal. I'm probably going to be caused as the bond issuer to pay up in short order. But I've got this building or I've got these assets. Would you do that for the discount that you could get? In other words, it's a zero loss game. Could there be a way that you can say, all right, Donald Trump, you got to put up $1 billion worth of property to get a $500 million bond?
It's unlikely. I haven't seen the former president's financial statement, but we're also not able to secure minority interests in properties. So if he's a 15% owner, 30% owner, how do you secure that?
Right, because you're negotiating with other people who make decisions about whether that property is going to be liquidated.
Correct. And we also have a very difficult commercial real estate market. Office space is empty. Finding a value for those properties, whether or not the debt's going to be refinanced, are all major questions that go into the underwriting equation.
Let me ask you about this company, this Truth Social merger that he's going into. In theory, that will net him some money. I have no idea how that works. In theory, he can't get that money for 6 months. But does that come into the negotiation that maybe the guy's going to come into a whole lot of money real soon?
So it's definitely going to be a factor. But at the end of the day, again, if you can't pledge or secure an asset, a surety company is not going to take it.
Right.
I've dealt with a couple different special purpose acquisition companies. And if they can't pledge their stock or they have a very small float, it's not really attractive proposition, because let's say you take $1 billion in that stock and you have to sell $1 billion, but the, you know, volume's 10 million. You're going to completely crash the stock. So right. The value of your asset that you used to secure the bond has diminished.
So it's possible that Donald Trump might be trying to use that against getting the money, but it's not going to be from a surety company. He might have to do it with other business partners or something.
Correct. Probably either other business partners or some sort of specialty lender.
Well, so there's been talk that as of Monday, Letitia James, in theory, can do something. She can go into a bank where he's got money, and can she actually get her hands on the money?
So I'm not an expert in post-judgment execution, but I believe she's going to levy the bank accounts, and eventually that's going to be turned over to the sheriff or the marshal, and then eventually is going to be turned over to the state of New York to satisfy a portion of the judgment. It's probably also going to be some further court proceedings to do so. So it's not going to be immediate on Monday, maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, how do you see this playing out? You seem to think that Donald Trump's got a plan. He's just trying to not execute on whatever plan it is, because he'd like to just basically use someone else's money for this if possible.
So I think he has a plan. I think at the end of the day, when he's backed into a corner and has to post the bond, I am confident that he's going to find a way.
All right. Neil, good to see you. Thank you for this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Neil Peterson is the owner of the New York-based Peterson & Sons Surety Bond Agency. Thanks for your time. All right, coming up, new details about the DOJ's investigation of January 6th under Attorney General Merrick Garland and how it all unfolded. To what degree did choices made early on play right into the hands of Donald Trump and his propensity for delay tactics? That's next. Donald Trump has literally done everything in his power to delay his January 6th criminal trial. At the moment, his argument of presidential immunity has put the brakes on Trump's case as the Supreme Court prepares to consider it. And that gambit may work by pushing a possible trial date closer and closer to the election. Today, we're learning new details about how the Justice Department's investigation into January 6th itself unfolded and how the process may have inadvertently played into Trump's hands. The New York Times reports that at the start of the probe, the Attorney General Merrick Garland encouraged prosecutors to, quote, follow the connective tissue upward, adding a directive that would eventually lead to a dead end, follow the money. With that, he set the course of a determined and methodical, if at times dysfunctional and maddeningly slow investigation that would yield the indictment of Donald Trump on 4 counts of election interference in August of 2023. As the Time notes that, as a result, prosecutors in the FBI spent months sticking to their traditional playbook. They started with smaller players and worked upward, despite the transparent, well-documented steps taken by Mr. Trump himself in public and behind the scenes to retain power after voters rejected his bid for another term. Joining me now is Ankush Kardori, senior writer for Political Magazine and a former Department of Justice federal prosecutor who specialized in financial fraud. Ankush, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell me what the issue is here, because this did unfold. The investigation sort of unfolded like a financial crime investigation would. You find people lower and lower on the totem pole, and you move your way up until you have enough evidence to convict the people on top. Why was that not the right strategy in this case?
So look, it's not necessarily how a financial fraud investigation works, particularly if you have a very large organization and a managerial class at the top. And you can roughly analogize that to what we saw on January 6th. You have all these people at the bottom, and then you have a hierarchy at the top, Trump, all these White House folks and the people in the Trump campaign orbit who are doing something at a higher level that may also warrant some scrutiny. These paths, like pursuing the rioters and pursuing Trump, the potential Trump campaign officials and people around him, Rudy Giuliani and the like, they were not mutually exclusive. That is the big problem with the premise underlying the Justice Department's approach here. They keep saying, even in this piece, we were just following a traditional playbook, moving ourselves from the bottom to the top. But it never had to proceed like that, and it shouldn't have proceeded like that. And it's important to remember that it was just a few days before January 6th that we all heard the call that Donald Trump had with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. That call alone, and I wrote a piece on this that published on January 6th, actually, that call alone warranted the opening of a federal criminal investigation as soon as Biden took office, or at a minimum, as soon as Merrick Garland took office.
So that's the question that many people have, and that is that if there appears to be evidence out in the open with participants in matters that needed to be examined, who could be subpoenaed and one could get information, why not move in that obvious direction? What was holding them back? Were they worrying about something else? Was there an investigation underway for which these added pieces of information did not sort of lend themselves? Why wouldn't the obvious be the case?
You know, it's a very good question, and this piece doesn't really answer it, right? Even though it's a remarkably good reporting. My sense, having also done a little bit of reporting around this, is that there was a real reluctance to pursue Trump in a manner that made it look like it was political retaliation, or that it was a Democrat pursuing a Republican, or some sort of partisan affair, and that sort of was something that Merrick Garland in particular was quite concerned about. And, some of the arguments in the piece that we hear from some of the officials who were involved are frankly, had me kind of pulling my hair out, because, you know, the piece quotes someone saying that, you know, in 2021, it was, quote unquote, simply inconceivable that Trump might ever return to the political stage. That person is quoted anonymously, and my sincere advice to them is to stay anonymous forever, because that was not true.
Right, because that's correct. There was nobody who believed that was true. I want to point out what you talked about, Merrick Garland. On the first anniversary of January 6th, Merrick Garland was asked by reporters about why this is taking so long. Here's what he said.
We understand that there are questions about how long the investigation will take and about what exactly we are doing. Our answer is, and will continue to be, the same answer we would give with respect to any ongoing investigation. As long as it takes, and whatever it takes, for justice to be done consistent with the facts and the law.
The problem is, the as long as it takes and whatever it takes are now coming up against one another.
That's exactly right. And I think the easiest way to think about kind of the path that was not taken by the Justice Department is to look at what the January 6th committee did, because they did pretty much exactly what I'm describing. Straight to the top, go to the principals, don't dilly-dally, you know, with the rioters and hoping that you can work yourself, you know, from them to Trump years down the line. Straight to the top, efficient, move aggressively, move quickly. And, you know, I think that, you know, the January 6th committee, you know, did a considerable service for the public just in revealing the facts, but they also demonstrated that the Justice Department's approach was deeply flawed.
I want to ask you about this as somebody who has dealt with financial crimes in the past. The Times reports that Garland told prosecutors to focus on the money. Department leaders believe that the best way to justify prosecuting Mr. Trump and the Willard plotters, talking about the Willard Hotel, was to find financial links between them and the rioters, because they thought it would be more straightforward and less risky than a case based on untested election interference charges. Look, we have the benefit of evaluating that thinking in hindsight, didn't turn out to be true. But what do you think about the fact that they started by taking that approach? Let's connect the money. I mean, we hear about that all the time. Follow the money.
Again, these things are not mutually exclusive. I mean, that's why the premise that the defenders here have adopted, it's just simply not true. I mean, let's just remember, again, Trump was already on a recorded call before January 6th, and it was apparent even from that call that Trump might have criminal exposure under Title 18, Section 241, which is one of the statutes he was eventually charged under. It is an election fraud statute. So these were not obscure issues. These were not things that people were not thinking about in real time, arguing about and advocating for in real time. Including, quite candidly, myself. I wrote a lot of pieces about this and about my concerns that the Justice Department was moving too slowly, and in particular, that there would be a problem if Trump eventually tried to return to power, that he may actually be able to outrun the case. And we're seeing that.
These cases are all important, but the January 6th case, because it's election interference, because it talks about the right to vote and to have your vote counted, it is the most important case. What's your sense of the likelihood of this going to trial before the election?
Look, I think it's unfortunately just brass tacks. I think it's fairly low. I would like to see it go to trial. I think the public's interest and the public imperative here is very strong, and that the law is on the side of having it move forward before November. However, the Supreme Court is moving slowly. I am concerned that they may try to send it back to Chutkan with some instructions to conduct some more legal analysis and potentially preliminary fact finding. If that happens, that could be the whole ballgame.
Ankush, thanks for joining us tonight. We appreciate your analysis and your expertise. Ankush Kordari is a senior writer for Political Magazine and the former Department of Justice federal prosecutor specializing in financial and white-collar crime. All right, one more story for you this evening. The Biden administration has a difficult new choice to make after Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu vows to press ahead with an attack in Gaza's civilian-dense city of Rafah. More on that after the break.
First and foremost, we want to see an immediate and sustained ceasefire as part of a deal that leads to the release of all hostages being held by Hamas and other groups, and that will allow much more life-saving humanitarian aid to get into Gaza. Every day without a deal means more needless suffering. This resolution will move us closer to securing that deal and help us alleviate that suffering.
Today, the United Nations voted on a Security Council resolution that was put forward by the United States, a resolution that, among other things, supported an immediate and sustained ceasefire of the war in Gaza. Now, while the vote was largely symbolic, this U.S. resolution contained some strong condemnations of Israel, the strongest we have seen since the start of the war. It represents a shift in U.S. policy that has slowly bubbled over the last few weeks. However, the resolution failed. Russia, China, and Algeria all voted against it, arguing that the resolution was far too ambiguous and had no direct call for a cessation of fighting. Simultaneously, as this failed vote was happening, other diplomatic efforts got underway. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Israel to meet one-on-one with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as part of America's belated diplomatic push toward a ceasefire and to deter an Israeli offensive into the southern city of Rafah, which is the last corner of Gaza, into which over a million civilians are now crammed. Even Vice President Kamala Harris today told reporters that she cannot see any safe way for Gazans to evacuate Rafah ahead of an offensive. Quote, there is nowhere for these people to go and be safe, she said. But after that meeting between Secretary Blinken and Prime Minister Netanyahu, it was clear that this push by the United States would not be enough to deter Benjamin Netanyahu. It appears he is dead set on invading Rafah and continuing the war, with or without the help of Israel's biggest ally. Netanyahu told reporters, we have no way to defeat Hamas without going into Rafah. And as I told Secretary Blinken, that I hope we will do it with the support of the U.S. But if we must, we will do it alone, end quote. To be clear, when it comes to military action, Israel is never alone. The U.S. supplies much of the money and materiel for its military. It's been such since the inception of the State of Israel, which is the largest recipient of U.S. taxpayer-funded largesse since its inception. Hence, President Biden now has yet another choice to make as it relates to this conflict. Will the U.S. use the tools at its disposal? Control over a lot of the military aid that goes into Israel to prevent what could become the bloodiest stage of the war? Or will it stand by as Netanyahu continues to be defiant with the continual financial and military backing of the United States? As Palestinians continue to die from injury and starvation by the thousands, the rhetoric from some U.S. leaders about the brutality with which Israel has prosecuted this war has, indeed, begun to change. The question is, will their actions? That's our show for tonight. You can catch me back here tomorrow and Sunday at 10 a.m. Eastern in my usual slot. I will be convening a special meeting of the Velshi Banned Book Club tomorrow to discuss one of the most banned books of all time, and one that is frighteningly relevant in this Trumpian era, George Orwell's 1984. My guests, James Allister, a political scientist who teaches a course on Orwell, and Garrett Conley, author of the banned book Boy Erased, a memoir about growing up gay in a fundamentalist Arkansas family. That's tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. Eastern.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.